Welcome to The Debate, Different Perspectives on the Federal News Update for Tuesday, September 9th, 2025. I'm Regan Bush, and I'm here to present the compelling case for decisive leadership and, frankly, a strong federal government, reflecting the conservative principles that are driving our nation forward.
And I am Carter Clinton. And I have to say, I'm deeply concerned about the implications of these recent federal actions for our democratic institutions and, you know, the civil liberties of all Americans. So I will be challenging those perspectives today.
Right. Today, we delve into some pretty significant activity from the executive branch, pivotal judicial rulings, and key legislative dynamics observed between September 6th and 9th, 2025.
And the central question before us is, what do these events, taken together, really reveal about the current state of governance in the United States, particularly when we look at the balance of power and its impact on, well, everyone, international partners, domestic businesses, and American civil society?
Well, the past week has truly showcased a presidency willing to take bold, necessary action. What stands out to me, first off, is President Trump's rebranding of the Department of Defense to the Department of War through an executive order. Now, this isn't just a name change. It's a strategic psychological reset. It recalibrates global perceptions of U.S. resolve and instills a warrior ethos internally, directly countering what the administration rightly views as a woke and overly defensive mindset that's been diluting the military's focus. By designating it a secondary title, the order ensures immediate implementation, signaling a new era of assertive deterrence rather than, you know, reactive defense, even as a longer-term strategy for a permanent statutory change is pursued. This is decisive, clear leadership. Furthermore, the U.S.-Japan trade framework, formalized by Executive Order 14345, is a landmark achievement. It establishes a transactional model of reciprocal tariffs and massive direct Japanese investment. We're talking about a $550 billion investment fund for U.S. critical industries, and $8 billion annually in U.S. agricultural goods purchases. This isn't your grandfather's free trade. It's a managed trade approach, a historic victory for American jobs, manufacturing, and reducing our trade deficit. It's effectively leveling the playing field for American producers and providing a robust template for future economic relationships, moving beyond, frankly, outdated multilateral models. And finally, the America Prays initiative launched by President Trump with guidance from the White House Religious Liberty Commission. This is a vital effort to restore faith to a central role in American public life and identity, coupled with forthcoming Department of Education guidance to protect prayer in public schools. These actions courageously advance religious liberty and directly counter secularist efforts to diminish faith's public presence. This administration understands the very soul of our nation and the importance of its spiritual renewal.
Well, I find myself deeply concerned by this surge of unilateral executive authority, the rebranding of the Department of Defense to the Department of War. It's far more than a symbolic name change. It's a dangerous shift. This unilateral executive order explicitly rejects a defensive posture, sure, but more critically, it represents a governance philosophy centered on the decisive use of unilateral executive authority. It deliberately bypasses Congress's exclusive purview, their sole constitutional authority to statutorily change a federal department's name. It's actively re-engineering the national identity of the military, and I think subtly normalizing aggressive postures. This move, in my view, uses executive fiat to advance a specific cultural and political worldview while completely circumventing the slower deliberative process Congress is meant to impose on such fundamental shifts. And as for the U.S.-Japan trade framework, well, while it's presented as a victory, it's a complex arrangement born from the, let's be honest, coercive leverage of tariffs. The economic realities are pretty stark. Analyses like Nomura Research Institute's estimate a 0.55% drop in Japan's real GDP, their total economic output, which could very well push them into a mild recession. And for us, the Yale University Budget Lab projects a 1.7% increase in prices for American consumers because of these tariffs. That's not leveling the playing field. It's a concerning shift away from multilateral free trade to a model where the executive branch wields, frankly, enormous power over international capital flows to direct industrial policy, often at the expense of consumer choice and economic stability.
Then there is the America Prays initiative, with its nationwide call for prayer groups and new school guidance.
This represents a significant and deliberate blurring of the traditional separation of church and state. It's not about religious freedom for all. Critics are rightly condemning this as an advancement of Christian nationalism. That's inherently exclusionary to non-Christian Americans and fundamentally undermines the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, which, you know, prohibits the government from establishing or endorsing a religion. And we haven't even really touched on the Supreme Court's alarming 6-3 decision in Nguyen versus Vasquez Perdomo, issued via the controversial shadow docket. For listeners, that shadow docket refers to these emergency rulings the court makes outside its normal calendar, often without full briefing, oral arguments, or, you know, detailed explanations, which leads to less transparency and scrutiny. This ruling, I think, gravely misuses judicial power by staying a lower court's injunction. It effectively allows Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE agents in Los Angeles, to use factors like apparent race or ethnicity, language, or presence at locations known for employing immigrant labor as a basis for detention. Justice Sotomayor's stinging dissent correctly identifies this as unconscionably irreconcilable with our nation's constitutional guarantees and an endorsement of tactics where agents seize first and ask questions later. It weakens Fourth Amendment protections and transforms the judiciary into an enabler of executive overreach.
That's an interesting and, I might add, a somewhat alarmist perspective. The president's actions, like the Department of War rebranding and the U.S.-Japan trade deal, exemplify a decisive leadership that is essential for national strength and economic competitiveness in what is, let's face it, a challenging global landscape. We are in a period characterized by, well, legislative quietude and Congress's fundamental inability to agree on and pass a formal budget. Just look at the full year continuing resolution. That means Congress is just funding government at last year's levels because they can't agree on new spending, effectively putting crucial new initiatives on hold. When Congress itself chooses to zero out the Technology Modernization Fund for FY 2026, calling it fiscal discipline, but really stifling necessary advancements in government IT, well, the executive branch is absolutely compelled to act.
The executive isn't overreaching. It's ensuring government efficiency and effectiveness where Congress is, frankly, paralyzed. Just look at the Treasury's cybersecurity enhancement account that saw a significant increase. That shows a focused, strategic approach to national security within a tight budget, which is exactly what the public demands.
To claim the executive branch is merely filling a void created by Congress is, quite frankly, a convenient excuse for what I see as a deeply troubling pattern of overreach. Okay, sure, Congress may be operating under a continuing resolution, and that's a failure of the legislature, certainly, but that does not grant the executive branch the authority to unilaterally redefine federal departments or, you know, reshape core economic relationships. The rebranding of defense to war is a deliberate bypass of Congress's exclusive purview. As experts like Philip Wallach have noted, Congress has, for decades, kind of ceded its authority in foreign affairs, and now we're seeing that power being used, well, rather capriciously, to fundamentally redefine our nation's military identity. And the trade deal, based on coercive leverage, grants enormous power over international capital flows to the executive.
This isn't just efficient governance. It's unilaterally crafting a new American foreign economic policy through executive fiat, completely outside of proper democratic oversight or the deliberative process. It's just not how our system is supposed to work.
I'm just not convinced by that line of reasoning. Critics of the Department of War rebranding often get hung up on semantics, completely missing the strategic message of victory and maximum lethality that's needed to ensure global stability in an increasingly dangerous world. This is about projecting strength and deterring potential adversaries, not inviting conflict. Similarly, the U.S.-Japan agreement is a pragmatic, innovative response to clear trade imbalances that were hurting America. It's specifically designed to protect American interests, stimulate domestic industries, and critically, create hundreds of thousands of American jobs. The executive is taking decisive charge where Congress is paralyzed, ensuring responsible use of taxpayer dollars and strengthening national security.
You can't accuse the executive of overspending when it's strategically cutting funds in some areas while boosting others like cybersecurity that are absolutely vital to our nation's safety.
But this isn't about semantics. It's about a fundamental reorientation of national identity and military posture, driven entirely by unilateral presidential directives. To suggest it's merely a strategic message when the White House's own document rejects a defensive posture and embraces a warrior ethos is, well, disingenuous. The words themselves have power, and changing the Department of Defense to the Department of War sends a clear, aggressive signal, both here at home and internationally. And this economic victory of the Japan deal, it comes at a clear cost. Nomura Research Institute projects a potential mild recession for Japan, and the Yale University Budget Lab estimates a 1.7% increase in the overall price level for American consumers. That's real money out of American pockets.
The idea that executive action simply fills a void ignores the deliberate weakening of legislative checks, including the administration's own push for a long-term continuing resolution, which effectively lets Congress choose irrelevance as a co-equal branch of government. Now, let's shift our focus to the judiciary, which, in my view, is increasingly enabling, rather than checking, this executive overreach. The Supreme Court's ruling in Noem v. Vasquez Perdomo is a devastating blow to civil liberties. It effectively sanctions what many, including myself, would call racial profiling. By lifting that lower court's injunction, it empowers ICE agents in Los Angeles to use these broad, constitutionally questionable factors like apparent race or ethnicity, language, or simply being present at locations known for employing immigrant labor as a basis for detention.
This is a crucial shift because it moves away from needing concrete, individualized evidence for reasonable suspicion. It potentially opens the door to broader, less justifiable stops based purely on appearance or location. Justice Sotomayor's dissent is explicitly clear. This is about agents who seize first and ask questions later. This judiciary is highly deferential to the executive branch, acting as an enabler for aggressive policies that erode Fourth Amendment protections fundamental to our privacy and security. And this pattern, it's further evident in that agreement with El Salvador to imprison Venezuelan migrants without legal counsel in the notorious CECOT mega prison and the ICE raid at the Hyundai factory in Georgia, which undermines international trade agreements and raises serious human rights concerns. These actions reflect a disturbing disregard for legal norms and, frankly, human dignity.
I respectfully disagree with that characterization, which I find to be an oversimplification of complex legal and national security matters. The Supreme Court's decision correctly upholds the government's ability to enforce federal statutes and protect national security from illegal immigration, particularly in areas grappling with immense border challenges. Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence articulates a sound legal basis, noting that the totality of the particular circumstances can indeed constitute reasonable suspicion for law enforcement. Preventing federal enforcement, as he argued, would cause irreparable harm to our national security and the rule of law. The administration's flood the zone strategy is a necessary measure to secure the border and ensure internal stability. Border Czar Tom Homan states it plainly, we're at war in the cartel. The DEA's recent operation, arresting over 600 individuals linked to the Sinaloa cartel, underscores the critical need for strong enforcement against these designated terrorist organizations. This is about law and order and protecting our communities, not racial profiling. The agents are acting on combinations of factors that indicate suspicious activity, not just appearance.
I find that defense of the Supreme Court's action profoundly concerning. The argument for national security simply cannot justify what amounts to a new, lower standard for reasonable suspicion that demonstrably allows for de facto racial profiling, impacting potentially millions of U.S. citizens and lawfully present residents. To say totality of circumstances is sound when those circumstances explicitly include race or ethnicity is to fundamentally misunderstand how these policies are implemented on the ground. and the use of the shadow docket for such a consequential decision avoids full scrutiny and signals a court that seems aligned with the administration's most aggressive policy objectives. And let's be very clear about the El Salvador deal. It specifically barred U.S. funds for legal counsel and set no conditions on the treatment of these individuals within that mega prison. That's a profound disregard for due process, plain and simple. It raises serious questions about whether the administration values law enforcement optics over its own diplomatic and trade efforts.
You are consistently exaggerating the impact and ignoring the specific context here. The Supreme Court's ruling explicitly mentions areas with a high population of undocumented immigrants and the combination of factors, not just one isolated trait, that can establish reasonable suspicion. This is about empowering agents to do their job effectively, not targeting innocent individuals. The administration is focused on upholding the rule of law and combating dangerous elements that threaten our communities. The measures with El Salvador were necessary to combat criminal elements filtering through migration routes, and the raid on the Hyundai factory was simply about enforcing immigration laws. These actions are distinct from economic policy and are absolutely necessary for national sovereignty and safety. We cannot have a secure nation if we don't enforce our laws, regardless of whether a business entity finds it inconvenient.
Now let's turn our attention to the administration's broader cultural direction and public health policy. The America Prays Initiative is a courageous call to recenter faith in American identity, a fundamental aspect of the nation's heritage, not an endorsement of a specific religion. The Department of Education's upcoming guidance on prayer in public schools is simply about restoring religious freedom for students, ensuring they are not penalized for expressing their faith. Furthermore, the Make America Healthy Again, or MAHA strategy, led by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., is a necessary reevaluation of public health priorities. This isn't anti-science. It's about ensuring scientific and medical freedom and thoroughly addressing what are viewed as potential vaccine injuries and other environmental exposures that have been ignored for too long.
And the swift removal of officials at Texas A&M following a challenge to gender identity content in a children's literature course. Well, that underscores the administration's commitment to protecting children from woke ideology and ensuring academic integrity based on published course descriptions. This is about accountability and parental rights in education.
I find the framing of these initiatives as simply restoring or protecting to be deeply misleading and frankly dangerous. The America Prays Initiative is a clear breach of the traditional separation of church and state. It's not about inclusive spiritual renewal when it's explicitly outlined in the White House's own document, President Trump's Top 100 Victories for People of Faith, which includes forming a task force specifically to eradicate anti-Christian bias. That is a targeted, not inclusive initiative, promoting what many see as Christian nationalism that isolates and excludes non-Christian Americans. As for the MAHA strategy, with the administration's broadly skeptical stance on vaccination and its reevaluation of fluoride standards despite overwhelming CDC recommendations for dental health, it risks nothing less than a public health crisis and potentially regressing to a period with much higher child mortality. Articles like MAHA-MAGA Moms and Vaccine Denial are directly calling out the dangers of this anti-vax rhetoric. And the Texas A&M incident, where officials were removed over course content, reveals the administration's use of executive power to suppress academic freedom and enforce a specific cultural and political worldview. It compels universities to align with political directives rather than educational autonomy. This is an attack on critical thinking and independent education itself.
Well, I am not convinced that calling America Prays exclusionary is fair at all. It's an inclusive call for national spiritual renewal, recognizing faith's foundational role in our nation. The MAHA strategy is not anti-vaccine. It seeks to modernize vaccines and ensure the best childhood vaccine schedule based on thorough scientific review. That's a responsible approach for parents who have legitimate questions, questions that have been ignored. Similarly, the reevaluation of PFAS standards, those forever chemicals, is about ensuring long-term safety, not rolling back environmental protections haphazardly. And the Texas A&M decision was about ensuring transparency and consistency in curriculum. It prevented the imposition of gender ideology content that was inconsistent with published course descriptions.
thereby upholding parental and student expectations. This isn't suppressing academic freedom. It's ensuring accountability to published academic standards and protecting children from ideologically driven curricula.
That's a compelling argument, perhaps, but I believe it fundamentally misrepresents the intent and the impact. To call America Praise inclusive ignores the explicit language from President Trump's top 100 victories for people of faith, which again outlines a task force to eradicate anti-Christian bias. That is targeted, not inclusive. The MAHS strategy's broad skepticism has already led to CDC leader resignations and a dangerous reevaluation of established public health norms, directly impacting the well-being of our population. And on PFAS, the decision to retain but delay standards for two types of these chemicals while removing and reevaluating others directly contrasts with previous administration's efforts to comprehensively regulate all forever chemicals. This signals a clear weakening of environmental health protections.
The Texas A&M situation sets a chilling precedent, where key leaders approve plans to continue teaching course content that was not consistent with the course's published description, implicitly aligning gender ideology with woke, simply to justify administrative intervention in academic matters. It looks very much like a political purge, not an academic correction, and it undermines the very autonomy of our educational institutions.
The actions of the past week, in my view, clearly underscore a necessary shift towards a more decisive, strong, and nationally focused federal government. These measures, from defense to trade and domestic policy, are designed to protect American interests, restore traditional values, and ensure efficiency, even if they challenge established norms and provoke, you know, spirited debate like this one. This is about realigning the government with the will of the people and demonstrating strength on the global stage that has been, frankly, lacking.
This period, however, highlights what I see as an alarming trend toward executive primacy, where the legislative and judicial branches are increasingly subordinate or, frankly, enabling. This centralization of power, coupled with policies that undermine civil liberties, democratic checks, and core constitutional principles, well, it demands vigilant scrutiny. These profound shifts will undoubtedly continue to shape American governments and society, necessitating active engagement and robust public discourse to safeguard our foundational values.
Right. While our interpretations diverge deeply on these developments, the ongoing tensions inherent in these actions are undeniable.
Mm-hmm. It's clear that understanding these multiple perspectives is really essential to fully grasp the complex interplay of governmental power and its implications for the future direction of the nation.
Absolutely. There is much more to explore in the material, and we encourage our listeners to continue to engage with these critical issues.